You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 3rd of November 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly digest of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One here at Midori House with me, Emma Nelson, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, Art Gallery or Art Hoover. We'll be talking about the new mega gallery springing up in the outskirts of Paris, and we'll be handing over to our Paris correspondent for a cultural look ahead in the capital.
What better way to begin your weekend in Paris than by taking a nostalgic look at the city you're in through the eyes of a Hollywood director?
Also ahead, we'll welcome the artistic director for Granta Publications, Michael Salou. He'll be taking a look at the best new titles in the literary world, not all of them involving words.
And to top it all off, we'll be talking about Boffin Bounds and Balearic Beats with our in-studio industry expert. You'll be hearing some cool tracks too, including this.
Crying birds and dying words.
A little touch of West Coast psychedelia there. So lots to look forward to this week on The Review here on Monocle 24. So indeed, a warm welcome to Studio One here at Midori House. Gillian, we normally start the programme off by taking our little cultural slice that we've enjoyed this week. And the one thing that struck me was not the more conventional areas of culture. I wanted to talk a little bit about retail culture.
That's because you were at the Chanel perfume booth. I know, yes. Shopping.
I went shopping and I was in a department store and I was meandering around the perfume counters, which is occasionally quite a pleasant thing to do. And I was stopping by the Chanel counter and I was aware that this had been around, but I was utterly knocked sideways by the craggy, bearded face of Brad Pitt staring at me over a bottle of Chanel No. 5. And I kind of get what they're trying to do, but I just was utterly thrown by it.
But isn't that the point? You were utterly thrown by it, and then we spent half an hour looking at the Chanel Brad Pitt ads online to find that also so have millions of others.
Yes.
And they've created a conversation.
It has inspired dozens of parodies of this little film, which by itself is quite a beautiful, simple, incredibly French.
Black and white, a very cerebral, poetic Brad Pitt.
Talking about the inevitability of something and whoever he is talking to is his fate, his heir, his destiny, what you name it, it is it. And then I just looked in the middle of this shop full of women, mainly, many with buggies, many with bags, many workers and what have you. And I just thought that there was this huge disconnect between...
I disagree with you. I think, you know, I'm just tired of beautiful women running downstairs and losing slippers and being thrust into the arms of a man for a perfume ad. And, you know, I love the idea of some heady, obtuse, attractive man selling me my perfume.
He's heady, he's obtuse, and no doubt he's very pleasant to look at. I'll absolutely grant you that. What I couldn't quite get is I wonder whether Brad Pitt is the right kind of person, because Brad Pitt perhaps has stopped being heady and obtuse and is now, I would venture, more readily associated with pictures of him getting off a plane with the Brangelina brood. And if you're trying to say, squirt this, you'll get someone like me, I wonder whether you think a happily settled man with loads of kids and a gorgeous partner is really the kind of person you want to sell your brand.
But you know, it's interesting. I mean, of all the brands, the amount of money that perfume companies invest in market research, this would have been very, very carefully researched to exactly get, to tick all the boxes, the kind of person that they think is going to attract the people who have the money and the inclination to buy their brand. So I would be fascinated to read the research that they went into to cast him.
The one thing I do admire Chanel for doing, though, is for trying to re-establish themselves a bit as being original.
Yeah.
Because when you look at Chanel and you think of Chanel No. 5 and you think of the heritage behind it, I wonder whether Chanel had kind of got lost in the mega brands of perfume, of mainstream perfume. You know, we talk a lot here in Monocle about artisan perfumes and individual little perfumers right around the world. And it's almost as if we've steered away from the likes of Chanel by lumping them in with everybody else who with their sickly sweet smells. I wonder whether Chanel's played an absolute blinder here by saying, just remember who the original one was.
Yeah.
It's very exactly. clever. It's very exactly. clever. But no, Brad Pitt staring at me over a foundation was...
Well, after
baffling.
The show, we can chat over lunch about who you would cast as the male.
We'll have a think.
We will move on. You are listening to Monocle 24. This is The Review.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And we begin today's review with our art review.
This past month has seen art fairs gather momentum in London and Paris. And next week, the baton passes on to Abu Dhabi. So joining us now in studio to talk about how a country grabs a toehold on the global art circuit and what it does for a nation's wider brand, we're joined by Ossian Ward, who is visual arts editor at Time Out London. Welcome.
Hi, morning.
I mean, I'm fascinated because the calendar seems to get more and more filled up with different art fairs. They seem very competitive in their nature to be different. And I'm wondering how important are they for a country's credibility on the contemporary art scene?
Well, yeah, the calendar is insane. And actually, I think a lot of the galleries are insane for doing them all. They kind of get into this thing where they think, oh, I should be there, I should be in Abu Dhabi, I should be in Turin later this month, then Miami. And, you know, no one else can keep up. So I'm not sure if the countries themselves use it quite in the same way as a landmark show like a biennial, like a Venice biennial or a Istanbul biennial. I think that's the one that you do to put your city on the cultural map. I think the art fairs that spring up are purely commercial. So the demand comes, ooh, Hong Kong, suddenly the money's moving to China, let's go to Hong Kong, let's open a fair there. Abu Dhabi and Art Dubai, which is in spring, are new, relatively new, obviously, considering that, you know, it was a desert 40 years ago. That, you know, but in terms of markets, they are really key sort of testers for the Middle East. And I think that quite a lot of the Western galleries kind of went the first year and then thought, oh, this is not quite for me. So there are a few, you know, a less strong group of Western galleries going this year because they find it really hard to contact and, you know, have sort of, you can't get face-to-face meetings with a lot of these shakers and sheikhs. So they're literally kind of scrabbling around. They don't know how to. A lot of the fair's work is done before the fair, so you will ask someone, oh, I'm bringing this Damien Hirst, I'm bringing this something. But with them, there's no way of contacting them. You have to have personal contact. So it's a bit of a lottery, especially in Abu Dhabi.
We've just seen Frieze here in London and the new Frieze Masters, which, speaking to people who went and who are connected to it, say was something that London had never seen before and was really a brand new idea and would be cementing London as on the map, not only in terms of its position in art, but its position in the art calendar. That is a new idea and it seems to have just been a success straight away. Why do you think Abu Dhabi and Dubai are still struggling to find a toehold? Is it because of the issue of not being able to talk to your customers? Or is it because it is such a new idea that there is no identity as such in the region?
Yeah, I think you're right. I think what a lot of galleries tell me is that this is the sort of the first generation of buyers there. So a lot of it needs to be education. So saying this is, you know, the kind of work that we're bringing. This is the kind of artist that you're looking at. And it's new to them. It's all new to them. So I think a lot of them are believing that it will be the next generation, the sons, or, you know, the next generation of collectors who will be the ones who really get it. So these, you know, rich families are buying, but they're not really sure what or why. They just know that they have to do it in a hurry. And we were saying that, you know, they're about to try and build all these different museums. So, you know, everything has to be done now. It doesn't really matter whether they know what they're doing or not. It's just like, let's speed up and let's build a collection.
They go with their shopping trolley.
Yeah. I was very interested reading about FIAC, which just took place in Paris, and about the new mega galleries on the outskirts of Paris, not just in the outskirts of Paris, but actually on the tarmac of Le Bourget private airport.
Yeah.
What does that reflect?
Well, that you've got to have a lot of money to get into this new Gagosian gallery. I just decided, again, it's another art fair last week in Paris, and I decided, oh, I don't need that after Frieze, but I am curious to see these galleries. One of them is the new Perrotin Gallery, a big space out in the sort of banlieue. But this one, the Gagosian one, is really interesting. It literally is Le Bourget Airport. You know, so, you know, people who are flying in can kind of stop off, have a little look around, maybe buy something, and then jet off again.
I was reading something this morning which I found was very reflective of what's happening there. The image of these airborne art hoovers is striking, once again distorting the role played by ultra-wealthy is depressingly clear. These galleries are effectively saying that the only audience for contemporary art that matters is that which can whisk in, those that can whisk in and out in an airport too lazy or stupid to catch a cab to the city.
I know. Well, it's the complete opposite of the sort of thing that I do. You know, being an art critic, my job is to look at this kind of work and present it to an audience. But when I know that the audience is not really invited, or, you know, I'm not even invited particularly because I'm not the kind of person that swings through this airport regularly, it does seem crazy. It seems like you might as well put them in free ports or put them behind completely closed doors
and
just be done with it. Yeah.
And as an art reviewer, do you see your job becoming increasingly marginalised as a result of this? And where do you see your role fitting into this?
That's a big question. yeah, we are a dying breed. I am the last practically extinct of my sort of genre. No, I mean, we are much less important than art critics were in the 50s, for example. Especially in America, or, you know, in Britain, there were certain powerful critics who could write something and really change a reputation. That's not the case anymore. We're a bit more reactive. The market is faster. The younger artists come up quicker or think they should be coming up quicker. So they're also trying to get there quicker. You know, no one's got time to sit and read and think about something before they digest it. They just want to buy it now. They want the next thing. So critics are a bit reactive, and there are not many of us left.
Is that partly because also a lot of the contemporary gallery owners have become stars in their own right, and so they convey the message about their artists the way they want to convey it, and they help stir a bit of the hype and the value at auction? And
oh, of course they do. Yeah, I mean it's a very cozy business for them. I think this big Gagosian, you know, in the airport is the kind of ultimate level of that, because it's sort of like trying to take out all the noise of the rest of it. There's no other people there. There's no kind of other buyers. It's not like the frenzy of a fair. It's very quiet and, you know, contemplative. But actually, you're a sort of caged lab rat. You're there for a specific purpose.
Well, let us release this particular caged lab rat and put you in your more natural habitat, which is a review of a new exhibition at an art gallery. We're talking about the National Gallery here in London, an exhibition called Seduced by Art, which is the pairing of master's art with brand new photography. Tell us a little bit more about the concept around it.
Well, I think, you know, Seduced by Art might be a bit of a strong title for it, because it leads you to believing there's some great love affair here, and the walls are very darkly painted and it's all very seductive. But what they're doing is presenting quite an academic treatise on how paintings influence photographers and vice versa. So what they wanted to avoid was really simplistic pairings, some of which are in there. So there's a really great Martin Parr of a kind of yuppie couple in their 80s house, right next to a Thomas Gainsborough portrait of Mr. and Mrs. Andrews, the kind of landed gentry looking over their land. And, you know, they're in similar poses. The idea is that it's transposed to the 20th century. You get it immediately.
That's not a new idea, though. We see the Arnolfini portrait inspiring generations of coupledom.
Yeah.
When when I was reading around it and looking at a lot of the pictures, these are specifically commissioned photographs, aren't they, to go with the masters, or have they actually gone out and found two pieces of art, one photographic, one painted, to place together and inspire?
Yeah, they've tried to make it more complicated than that. I think there are some new works there, but there are a lot of existing works. So they've tried to find more nuanced ways between photography and painting. But it doesn't work terribly well because you either want it to be a simple kind of compare and contrast, or you get really lost in who's influencing who. So you have a whole room of photographs which are supposed to be influenced by a Delacroix painting, the Rape of Sardanapalus or the Death of Sardanapalus. It's kind of destructive bedroom scene. So you can see echoes of it in the other photographs, but then you don't have the original painting there. It's an enormous painting in the Louvre, so you get this tiny little copy. So you're looking at a copy, then a version, then a homage, then a photo of that. And it gets really confusing. They wanted to avoid the really obvious ones, like, you know, this still life looks a bit like an old still life, you know.
And how do they turn it inside out? By showing how the art world gets inspired by photography? How do they turn it on its head?
Well, I think what they want to do is show that it's reciprocal, so that, you know, photographers look at paintings, but, you know, painters might also look at photography. But their none too subtle point is basically that painting is better than photography because the old masters knew it better. And that's quite hard to argue with when you see a beautiful still life painted or a beautiful landscape and then a photograph of that landscape, because you think, oh, well, that's just a photograph. It doesn't have that kind of lively quality, the sort of natural light or something you get from a painting that makes it magical. Quite often with a photograph, unless it's really big and really impressive, we're used to looking at photographs, so the paintings tend to come off better anyway.
I think that that's something that automatically leads you to the conclusion that, you know, when you do a compare and contrast of the photograph and a painting, you just think Caravaggio and Vermeer got it so right so early and were streets generations ahead of everybody else who ever followed. Do you think that unfortunately belittles photography as an art form? Because some of the more reactionary critics this week have been saying this has proved that photography is not art, which is incredibly out there, but you kind of understand what they're trying to say.
Yeah, I think what you know, the problem with the National Gallery is they haven't chosen the best examples. So there's no Andreas Gursky, there's no Cindy Sherman. They should have gone with the bigger names, even if they don't necessarily copy from old masters. The idea of something epic or something bold or brave or exciting should be in the photographs as well, rather than pale pastiches of paintings. The best bit of the show is actually when you leave and there are three works hidden in the collection. And partly that's nice because it does kind of ruffle the feathers a bit of the National Gallery. But it's also great because you get to see people wandering past a John Constable and then coming to a Richard Billingham. Two Japanese tourists took ages to work out that it was actually a photograph. They were looking at it really hard. And then there's a nice portrait of Ang next to a sort of 20th century version.
And is this a Madame Moitessier and Jasmine and Mary Quant, which I saw the two pictures next to each other.
Yeah.
And how did it work to you? Because when I saw it, I thought, this is laboured, this is self-conscious. Mm. Neither work is ultimately satisfying in itself anyway. It didn't work for me.
No, it doesn't work as a comparison because it's too obvious. It's a bit like saying, oh, look,
here's a lady in a dress, here's another lady in a dress.
Here's a lady in a pretty dress, here's another lady in a pretty dress. But I liked, again, another reaction from one of the visitors who said, oh, that must be his granddaughter. Mm. You know, they really didn't get that it was supposed to be a sort of aesthetic coupling. They just, you know, people assume that the photograph is there for some sort of historical reason or something. You know, it's not a work of art in its own right. And I think that's the problem. The photos that they've chosen are too weak to really compete or compliment.
I suppose what surprises me a little bit about the concept, unless it was very, very well executed, is that art has always surprised all sorts of cultural creativity, from fashion designers to writers to musicians. It's not necessarily surprising that art is an inspiration. And often the photographers, they don't necessarily pretend to be great art. Their work ends up maybe in art galleries, but that's not their original reason for going out and taking taking the art. And I ended up, I covered a couple of weeks ago the Prix Pictet, which is a photography a prize for sustainability. And it was exhibited in the Saatchi Gallery. On the walls, it looks like art, but these are, a lot of them are photojournalists. They go to cover a story and a message. They end up looking like art, but that wasn't their reason.
Well, funnily enough, the winner of that prize, Luc Delahaye, he comes out of this show probably the best. There's a wonderful two panoramic pictures, one just a kind of bombed out bit of Afghanistan, and another of this big sort of tumultuous meeting, UN meeting or something, with all these people and photographers all crowding around the centre. And it looks like a history painting. It looks like it's been beautifully composed. They're
like
all actors.
Like The Last Supper or...
Yeah, exactly. It has that feel, but they're not. You know, it's just a snapshot. And I think that's what they've laboured the point too much. They've got artists or photographers who are trying too hard to kind of make their work look a bit old mastery.
Well, we've just published a film out a couple of days ago on the Prix Pictet, so listeners can watch my film on the Prix Pictet and the photographs therein.
Ossian, I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there for the time being. That was Ossian Ward, Visual Arts Editor for Time Out London. Thank you very much indeed for joining us in the studio. You're listening to The Review on Monocle 24.
The November issue of Monocle takes the pulse of the world as we investigate how good healthcare makes a nation. We reveal who has the best nurses, meet a mayor who put his city on a diet, and visit a hospital the size of a city. And there's lots more to make you feel better about the world too.
In the business section, we find out about the healthy Japanese tipple that represents a $1.2 billion industry. We take to the skies with the CEO of Australia's Royal Flying Doctor Service, and our Washington correspondent profiles the small businesses making a healthy profit on the US presidential campaign trail.
In the affairs section, we go on the road with an elderly band of diplomats. I sit down with Malaysia's Mr. Fixit, and we also present our 10-point plan for the next US president, whoever that may be.
In the design section, we tackle grey matters, looking at three pioneering projects designed for the elderly around the world. We also create our own perfect community in which to grow old. Elsewhere, we drop in on a beautiful new cancer treatment centre by Nord Architects in Copenhagen that's more like a home than a hospital.
The November issue of Monocle also includes a special expo that limbers up with Japanese companies as they bend knees and reach for better profits with the aid of morning exercise routines. It's all on newsstands now and also available via subscription at monocle.com. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
The menu is Monocle 24's weekly look at good food, great drinks, and the makers behind these experiences. Each week we serve up the latest in cuisine around the world, from top chefs to tiny breweries, and of course, the best baristas.
Coffees that really stand out, that jump off the table, is what we're always looking for.
On the latest edition, we head to Singapore to find out about vertical farms. We find out how Colombians are promoting their local cuisine, and we meet a photographer focusing his lens on the culinary world, Todd Selby.
Food is just so happening right now, and I feel like there's so much creative energy and real do-it-yourself spirit.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Well, our musical guest for today's review is a DJ, a producer and music consultant too, Christopher Tubbs. Originally from New Zealand, now native of London, Christopher advises brands on how to use music too. Welcome back to The Review, Christopher.
Good afternoon, ladies.
Good afternoon. Let's briefly talk before we move on to what your music choices are. This week we saw the Mercury Prize in London. Were you aware of, were you connected to it in any way, or did you watch it?
I was only connected to it in the sense that I know a lot of friends of mine who are in the industry are essentially holding their heads after a very heavy night, still recovering.
It had gone a bit edgier this year.
That's right, Al Jay coming. Well, that's right. They'll be doing the Walk of Shame for the weekend, I'd say. And aside from that, on a more sort of artistic bent, I know nothing about it.
Marvelous. Yeah. I mean, because what you're within the music industry, I think there was a lot of discussion about what the press are calling the rise of boffin rock, which is kind of middle class, university educated young people who are now coming in and making a mark for themselves, not only musically, but in the way that they're marketing themselves. They claimed when they won the prize that they've turned the music industry into a completely level playing field because they've broken all the rules. They were streaming their album online before its release. They fired their press officers because the press officers couldn't get them a review in the broadsheets. How much do you see this as a driving force or a completely new direction that music is inevitably taking?
I think it's the democratization of music. It's certainly not an instant thing. It's been happening for the last few years. But in terms of it becoming a sort of viable model, I would say that's only really happened in the last year and a half. And you talk about sort of, you know, well-educated kids kind of sensibly and consciously making the decision to get into music as a career. I think that's fascinating, you know, kind of parentally endorsed, you know, careers in music.
Daddy, when there's paid for my album.
Yeah. Yeah. But you can actually rationalize it. You know, you can actually, if you have a grasp of social media, if you know who your audience is, you know, if you can work out some kind of 2-year projection as where you think your music might end up, then you've got a shot.
Now that people can, you know, promote themselves in so many more ways, do awards still have the same value and importance as maybe they used to?
Oh, I think they do. I think you know, the affirmation of your peers is just as valuable as a record sold.
Which are the big awards? Which are the awards around the world that really kind of matter?
Oh, good question.
I
think the Grammys are sort of to most bands is the Oscars, definitely. But I think things have changed in the sense that there's a lot of music blogs and websites who have very kind of low-key awards now, which to your fledgling artists, groups, or even labels mean a lot more because it's their direct circle.
You get the devotees.
Exactly. They're getting the endorsement of the geeks. Mm-hmm. And when you first start, that's what you're after.
I think a lot of us forget that the whole original idea of the Mercury was devised apparently by the head of marketing of Virgin, who was behind the anybody who ever had a CD player or even an old cassette in the 1980s will remember Now That's What I Call Music, those compilations that drenched the British music market. And the idea behind the Mercury was not to bring new talent to the fore, but was to shift more records at an essentially dead time of the year. Do you think that everything is so commercially driven now that we do actually forget the fact that there are these underground or these small websites or what have you that are marketing their own things?
I think things have never been less commercial in the sense that they're not so much about selling records as they are commercial in the sense that they are about selling out tours or selling merchandise. Do you know what I mean? The traditional concept of making money from the music industry is kaput. It's gone. Yeah. Unless you are a very rarefied circle of, you know, of Radiohead, U2, et cetera, who still essentially, you know, aside from the way they sell records, which is different, they still operate on the model of selling millions of records.
Well, let's move on to your music choices for today on the review. You're talking about bringing new songs in. What's the first choice is Lucassy and Rasheen Murphy. Tell us a little bit about this before we play it.
Well, these guys have been kind of long-term muckers. And
Is this nepotism, Christopher?
Oh, no. I mean them, not me. I do know Lucassy and Brigante. Damn it, I shouldn't have mentioned that. But Royce Murphy is an old friend of theirs, and it's a fantastic collaboration. Lucassy and Brigante have released this very Balearic, there's that word again, album last year, which is a real swing across the spectrum of psychedelia through to disco. And this is a very good representation of kind of where dance music is now. It's quite sparse, really bass-driven, but it's got this wonderful kind of, I don't know, left-field pop sensibility to it.
Let's have a listen. That was Lucas E. and Briganti featuring Rasheen Murphy, Flash of Light there. The choice of today's music expert, Christopher Tubbs. Christopher, that you said had a lyric feel to it. Now, many of us would be under the assumption that it's a bit too chilly to be hitting the beaches of Ibiza at the moment.
Well, I think this is why Balearica has such a sort of huge following in Britain, especially because, I mean, I know a lot of people who collect records incessantly and obsessively, who call themselves Balearic DJs but have never been to Ibiza. You know, because I think they have this sort of mythical visualization of what this wonderful warm place where everyone's smiling all the time.
And the sun sets and everyone watches it go down and it's all wonderful.
It's and yeah, come exactly.
Up. The sun sets and rises regularly. But what happens when everyone shuts up shop in Ibiza? The spirit does not die, you say?
I think it's a bit of it's quite a sort of windswept, you know, desolate place actually in the winter. It's
sounds
you know
quite lovely there.
Yeah, well, it becomes a real island town where there's only a few restaurants left open. It's a combination of people who have traditionally lived on the island, or generations of people have lived on the island, as well as a few burnt out ravers who just never quite made it back.
And Balearic music has been around for a while, and forgive the pun, but how does it stop getting stuck in a groove? How does it sort of move on?
Well, the thing with Balearic music is that it doesn't belong to any one genre. Mm. It doesn't belong to any one sound. It's kind of a feeling. And then there are huge arguments that go on for years on forums, you know, on the internet, between people who keep trying to redefine what Balearic music is. And the thing is that everybody has a different opinion about Balearic music. It's such a kind of ethereal concept. It's just music that has a certain chordal feel, a certain sort of psychedelia or euphoria to it that just makes you think of certain scenarios and sunsets.
You were mentioning a bit of psychedelia. Let's move on to your next choice of a song, which I would argue has a tiny touch of psychedelia in it. This is Stepkids and Sweet Salvation. Why have you chosen this?
It's you know, you're right. It is literally just a, you know, kind of gently iced with psychedelia, shall we say? Yeah. But it's representative of a movement on the West Coast that is definitely reinventing soul in a kind of mid-70s blue-eyed soul with an electronic tinge kind of sense. And these guys are on a fantastic record label called Stone's Throw, which was traditionally a hip-hop label in the 90s, but has become very expansive in its old age in the 21st century. And I've seen these guys perform recently, and they are one of the tightest bands I've seen in the last decade.
Let's have a listen.
Yeah.
And that was A Taste of Stepkids and Sweet Salvation, the choice of Christopher Tubbs, our guest reviewer on today's review. That was, when I first heard that, I thought there's loads and loads of different influences in that. There's psychedelia, there's a tiny bit of Bowie. You mentioned the West Coast of America.
Yes.
Very, very Beach Boys. And I listened to the entire track, well, most of the entire track. It had that sort of tight-knit feeling to the beginning of it, and then it just seemed to go off somewhere, and at that point I pressed stop. It has real deep psychedelia halfway through, doesn't it?
I think it definitely does, and I think that's sort of the underlying idea behind this band, is that they're basically saying, look, yes, we can write pop hooks, we understand how to compose records that you can sing along with, but in essence, we are a psychedelic band, and I'll show you how. Bing, bang.
Absolutely.
But also, what I'm thinking is that's why the element of the surprise in the performance. You know, you don't want a song where everything's
they're a live band,
similar throughout beginning, middle, and end, and suddenly it's like when you hear them live, then let's take you on a journey, and that's
right. I love bands who are good enough to provide a completely separate experience to the recorded one.
Where is the market for psychedelia at the moment? It's passed me by. Oh, and maybe this is where I'm going wrong. Introduce us, Christopher.
There are so many. I mean, I had a guy come up to me last week with a flyer saying, just started as a person I knew who said, I've just started a psychedelic night down at, you know, Momo's, and you've got to come. And and
God,
bizarrely,
help us, that sounds dreadful.
It sounds horrendous.
I think it sounds wonderful.
I so hope they're not listening. They'll know who they are. And the first thing that popped in my head was, oh my God, not another psychedelic night. Now that's quite telling. There are about four psychedelic nights going on in East London that I know of, and I don't know what it is because it's not entirely danceable. It's kind of very much a sit on cushions and
it's head noddy.
It is head nodding.
Very head noddy.
Which, by the way, I saw a lot of. There was a lot of head nodding going on in the studio during the Step Kids.
It's. I mean, very briefly, we're going to move on to. I was nodding.
Busted.
Is it? Maybe. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I always found that psychedelia was quite a macho kind of music. It was a boy. It was a teenage boy in his bedroom kind of music.
Yes, I think it's sort of closely associated with young men's first experiences of drugs.
Right.
Yes.
That was what I was trying to say, quite diplomatically. We must move on, I'm afraid, Christopher, because time is running out of us. Your final choice for this morning, Dan Bowden, Under a Cancer Sky, a Canadian artist based in Berlin. The picture of him that I saw looked absolutely nothing like how I expected him to be. He looks like a 12-year-old, again, a teenage boy in his bedroom with the faintest trace of a whisker. But this is really quite soulful, quite dark music, isn't it?
It's beautiful. It's something that was written in 2009 and something he'd been singing for his friends for a long time. And he wrote a demo version of it, which is really lo-fi. There's as much hiss as there is music in this recording. And he essentially met Alexis Taylor at the Berghain, Alexis Taylor being the vocalist for Hot Chip, who was very much a Marmite singer, if there ever was one, which is, you know, a sure way to get a fanatical audience and a sure way to get a dissenting blog audience, if there ever was one. And he has basically done this fantastic cover. It's slightly glossier. It's wonderfully wistful. And it's got a sort of David Lynchian feel to it as well. I can imagine it on the soundtrack to The Straight Story or something like that.
It is rather murky. Let's have a listen. This is Dan Bowden, Under a Cancer Sky.
You're still listening to Heartbreaker. Cruising by, we arrive at a
And that was Dan Bowden, Under a Cancer Sky, the final choice of our music expert this week, Christopher Tubbs, the DJ producer and music consultant. Very briefly, because I'm afraid time has run out of us. When I heard that, I did want to go and knock on his bedroom door and ask if he was all right. That made me very worried.
He wanted to ring his mum.
I needed to ring his mum and check he was okay. That was a very vulnerable piece of music.
A lovely one.
So, Christopher, I'm afraid we're going to have to say goodbye. That was Christopher Tubbs, originally from New Zealand, now native of London, DJ, producer, music consultant too. Thank you very much, as ever, for joining us here in the studio on today's review.
Thank you for having me.
Now, time for our weekly in-depth city look ahead. We asked our correspondent, Tom Burgess-Watson, our Paris correspondent, to provide us with a look ahead of what he's recommending this weekend if you happen to find yourself in the City of Light.
What better way to begin your weekend in Paris than by taking a nostalgic look at the city you're in through the eyes of a Hollywood director? For more than a century, the French capital's been the backdrop for more than 800 American romances, action films, musicals, even cartoons. The exhibition Paris Vu par Hollywood takes you on a journey from the days of silent film through the Belle Époque and to the present day. That's running until the 15th of December at Hôtel de Ville. Now, chocoholics, take note. You've got until Sunday evening to visit the 18th edition of the annual Salon du Chocolat. With its 13,000 square metres dedicated to cocoa, it claims to be the largest event of its kind in the world. You've got the opportunity there to rub shoulders with some of the greatest chocolatiers on earth and also to take part in the expo's activities, conferences, workshops and, wait for it, tastings as well. There's also a fashion show. Well, that's at the Porte de Versailles Exhibition Centre and it ends on Sunday. France is home to one of the largest Lebanese communities in the whole world, 250,000 people. And hitting the cinemas this weekend is Pays Rêvé, or Dream Country in English, which is a film by the Franco-Lebanese director Jihan Shuaib, which tells the story of four people, each of them trying to carve out their own Lebanese identity, grappling with what it means to be from a country they don't necessarily know all that well. The Pitchfork Music Festival Paris is now in full swing. That's running till Sunday. 40 artists have flocked to the Grande Halle de la Villette in the north of Paris for this, the second ever French version of the Chicago-based Electro Festival. Well, tonight, Saturday, is the final night of the event, considered by many to be a mecca of indie music. Check out their website, pitchfork.com, for full details of tonight's lineup. And finally, entry to most Paris museums is free on the first Sunday of every month, although that can mean rather long queues. Well, worth lining up for outside the Grand Palais is the retrospective of the American realist painter Edward Hopper, which is regarded as being one of the most important exhibitions of the year. Well, Hopper, of course, knew and painted Paris, discovering the joie de vivre on his first ever visit in 1906. Not one of his works is owned by a French gallery, so here's a chance to see 160 Hoppers, many of them privately owned and rarely seen in public. For Monocle in Paris, I'm Tom Burgess-Watson.
And you are listening to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back with Michael Salou, Artistic Director for Granta Publications.
If you like Subways, not Subway sandwiches, if you want to know what makes a metropolis thrive or take a dive, and if you prefer the concrete jungle to the muddy field, then you need The Urbanist. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we explore the urban landscape by tram, subway and taxi to meet the people out to make urban life even better. In this episode of The Urbanist, we're looking at innovation and design in the urban environment. We're going to be going to Eindhoven, where they're rethinking what the road should look like. We'll ask, is Warsaw the next city ripe for investment? And we're also going to be at the inaugural City Summit in Tel Aviv.
Tel Avivians never give up. If something doesn't work, they try again, they try again, they try again, they try again. Which is why Tel Aviv can go through cycles, it can go through dips and peaks. It can be founded on the sand dunes and 100 years later, it can be one of the most famous cities in the world.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
It's Saturday here in London, so that means you must be listening to The Review with me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias.
And next in studio, we have Michael Salou, the Artistic Director of Granta Magazine. Michael has designed book covers for classic works by, to name a few, Raymond Carver, Marcel Proust and Bruce Chatwin. He comes to us with a distinct design-driven perspective on literature and the contemporary literary scene.
I'm delighted to say Michael joins us today in the studio for a literature review, which inevitably will have to take an artistic slant. Welcome again, Michael.
Thank you.
Okay, let's address this idea of the fact that you're the artistic director. Mm. How do you then approach a book when you read it? I'm assuming you read it slightly differently to the way that many others would.
I think I do. I think I sort of go in and try and extract sort of either visual narratives or concepts, or maybe it's the way the book is structured that then informs what I do visually. But there's so many sort of different tangential ways of actually reading the text.
It's not the obvious. I mean, obviously, the beauty of book design is it's not the obvious.
Precisely.
It has to allude.
So I think it's more of an illustration of the space between the lines than the actual... Yeah.
It is a huge issue, isn't it? Because the joy of a book is the fact that it is not illustrated.
Yeah.
So how do you manage to strike that balance of being complementary yet not swamping your reader with a visual image which overwhelms their ability to read?
I think it's quite a thing. I try to sort of lead them into it, so you don't give too much away with the imagery. I think the idea is to intrigue, and sometimes that can be a totally abstract notion, and it's only once you've read the book then you actually go back and you can make sense of the imagery. But as long as it's quite captivating and it starts the sort of discourse or the relationship with the book, then that's the job done, in a sense.
It was something that I absolutely underestimated until regular listeners of The Review will know my antipathy towards the e-book. that I was... my feelings are very well known on this subject, that... when I was reading an ebook, I suddenly realised how much I underestimated the power of the cover of the book, because it not only gave you a tone of what the book felt like to read. But it also reminded you of what the title was.
Absolutely.
Which you can actually forget when you're stuck reading a blank page.
Well, I think that's the thing, is that there's a, you know, the e-book reading devices are still fairly rudimentary. And I think there's also a little bit of tendency to overcompensate from publishers and thinking, well, you have this digital space and you need to overpopulate it with sort of gimmicks and quirks, when in essence you want to get the pure reading experience and that's that. But I think gradually the sort of visual language that's going to work for digital will get there in a way that we do with book covers.
Well, let's move on to one of your choices. We know that the magazine aspect of Granta will have to be reserved for the stack, because that is where magazines have now moved to. But obviously, we have to focus on the fact that Granta is a magazine, although I consider it a collection of short stories every time I read it. Your latest issue is focusing on Brazil, which is obviously joining in the popular focus on Brazil in anticipation of what it's going to offer us in the next couple of years. How do you approach the idea of a whole nation whose literary tradition many of us will not have experienced before?
That was pretty much why we decided to do this. And I think it's another example of, we see that this magazine very much is a sort of international cultural space. So though it's a very British magazine, you know, we have a very outward way of looking at the world. So there's writers from all over the world, depending on what theme we're writing about. And I think that this is a really clear example in that Brazil has a lot of exposure now due to its sort of economic resurgence and so on and so forth, but we don't know that much about it culturally beyond football and, say, music. And I think that's why we wanted to delve in and have a look at the literary scene. So we worked with a Portuguese publisher in terms of, you know, acquiring these works and translating them and so on for the Western audience.
South American literature has been very much known for magic realism and surrealism, but do you think the new Brazilian writers are writing more about the urban experience and reality? What are the themes?
Very
that
much
kind
so.
Of
I mean,
it's
almost every piece in there has an urban setting or context in some sort of way, and it's very much it's interesting because it's an interesting mirror to the way we live here. And if you look at sort of contemporary British writers, you know, the likes of Adam Fault and Mark Haddon and so on, there's very much that sort of focus here where they delve into sort of the, you know, the minutiae of our everyday kind of existence, but it just happens to be set in maybe Brazil, I mean, in Rio or Sao Paulo or so on. So there's lots that you can identify with, but obviously the cultural differences and idiosyncrasies are what makes this really interesting.
What I find interesting about Brazil, and I will go off and read this collection of short stories, is the fact that, and Gilly and I were talking about how you define a young country in terms of a literary heritage, but Brazil, in terms of its literary heritage, is relatively new because of the influence of Portugal and then the African tradition as well. How much do those traditions, those young traditions, drive the literature of today in Brazil? Do people look back, or do they just look at, you know, who inspires them from the past?
I mean, the literary scene isn't as expansive as one might think, and there are those that sort of reach in, and I think South America has more of an influence, and let's say, you know, the likes of Borges and Roberto Bolaño and so on. There's a very strong influence from those writers on these new, but they're very much looking at now and looking at Brazil as part of a more global place. I mean, you know, it is a sort of cultural sort of form of globalization in a sense. So the writers are writing about Brazil, but they're writing about Brazil today primarily.
I love the idea in this compilation where you have introductions to the new Brazilian writers, but the introductions are written by past Granter young novelist winners or writers in your books. Can you explain what that adds to the stories?
We want to sort of put them in a place, as in it's sort of like announcing their arrival. And I think, you know, most of these people will be unheard of to, you know, UK and international audiences. And I think it's a rather nice way of sort of presenting them as a new kind of voice, as a new generation of really, really interesting writers. So it was sort of nice to sort of detach, add another
layer.
A bit
like matchmaking,
absolutely,
though, who introduces who.
So add another layer of that kind of, you know, relationship and conversation that's happening there between, you know, the sort of the literary generations.
Let's move on to another book of sorts that you have brought us in, because it is not yet published. It's a collection of A4 sheets, ladies and gentlemen, that Michael's brought in today. obviously, being an art director, the book that you have brought in has no words in it. It's a collection of photographs, vernacular photography.
That's right. It's a super sneak preview, hence it all being loose sheets. I was very keen to talk about this because our recent Medicine issue of Granta, I published a selection of the photography of Brad Feuerhelm. He's a collector of photography and has been collecting for, say, 15 years or so. And this here is his first entire book of vernacular photography. Vernacular photography being that kind of photography which wasn't initially intended as an artistic statement. It tends to be quite everyday, you know, sort of amateur photography.
It's the triumph of the everyday,
absolutely,
isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. So the element of chance and circumstance and all these things that comes into this work is what's really, really powerful and really engaging.
I notice that Gillian has been particularly tickled by
sitting on a pumpkin.
No, but yeah, but it says chance of the everyday. How everyday is that?
I don't know about you, Gillian, but I don't have chairs in my house. I just have vegetables.
But it's a really rich collection, and I think what's really engaging about these works is the fact that it exists outside of the officialdom of the press photography that we're used to seeing, and I think that's what immediately grabs you here.
How does it give a helping hand to photographers who are finding it probably nigh on impossible now to find themselves and to get themselves noticed?
I think it's probably quite challenging. I think this sort of form of presentation of photography is quite challenging to the photographer because the photographer's process is often very controlled. I mean, you might stage an image, you might have a beautiful concept, especially fine art photographers. And then this does, to me, it does a similar thing, but in a much more reactionary way, much more kind of random way. And I think that sort of process can feed into you know, a traditional photographer's work. I mean, maybe bring in the element of chance, maybe bring in those burnt negatives and so on and so forth that just add another dimension to.
When we were at the Arles Photography Festival in the summer, there was a whole section given over to book publishers. But there was this sense of frustration that photography books are so expensive often to publish, so it is very hard for photographers to find publishers. And now there is this sort of more young sort of self-publishing vein happening.
Which is where this this title comes from. There's an organisation called Self Publish Be Happy, which is set up by Bruno Cheschel. And I believe this is probably their second title now, which is there to support artists and help, you know, them fund and build their own books. Because I think it is, you know, if you're not with Thames and Hudson or Stidor, it's very difficult to get exposure.
Michael Sully, I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there. Our thanks to Michael Sully, Artistic Director of Granta there. That brings us to the end of today's review. For now, it's been goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. This show was produced by Katie Bilboa, David Michon and Marcus Hippie, a joint venture indeed, and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. For all of us, me, Emma Nelson and Gillian DeBias, goodbye.
Goodbye.